My mom almost got scammed this one time, not long ago. She'd met a guy who seemed promising, a white dude who prayed with her over the phone and talked about business deals he was making all over the world. She had been struggling for a while. She'd bounced across a half dozen cities over the past decade, started and ended a bunch of jobs, sometimes grinding two or three gigs at a time to keep the rent paid and the lights on, and life was only getting harder. By the end of 2018, she hadn't broke even in months. Her credit card debt rose to sums she would only whisper to me, even when nobody else was around. The temp agency she was working for hadn't given her an assignment in weeks. On the last, filing papers for a property management company at a Section 8 apartment complex, a tenant had threatened to shoot up the place after learning he was getting evicted. My mom was so scared that her boss let her go home early. OMG, what a stress, she had texted me, punctuating the message with an emoji of a frowning face with a bead of sweat dripping from its forehead. She was living in San Francisco now, in the cramped ground floor unit of a creaky two-story duplex that had been in our family for decades. Her landlord, her cousin-in-law, kept the rent at a family discount. The space had once been a doctor's office, and it was drafty and narrow. When I visited from New York, as I did once or twice a year, I slept on the couch, bundled in a hoodie, nodding off to the Gregorian chants coming from the boombox in my mom's bedroom. The neighborhood used to be known as the Fillmore District, or the Western Edition, but newcomers call it NOPA, for North of the Panhandle, because the developers buying up the housing stock and the brokers writing the listings want to distance their increasingly valuable buildings from the area's reputation as a historically black community. In recent years, the area began sprouting the amenities you might expect from a place with a name like NOPA. A cafe serving $7 toast, a bar decorated with surrealist art available for purchase, a three-floor entertainment center featuring vintage arcade games, one-bedroom condos going for $700,000, a world of luxury just outside my mom's door, but tauntingly out of reach. The contrast was disconcerting. As the neighborhood's prospects brightened, hers only dimmed. She always assured me she was doing fine. She described her days to me as simple and peaceful, and as evidence sent me photos from her early morning walks on Ocean Beach, dogs splashing in the tide, jellyfish washed ashore, messages she wrote in the sand like, "Happy birthday, Jesus," with a heart dotting the exclamation point. She collected shells, stones, and sand dollars, some for their unusual colors, some for their smooth, perfect form, some because they bore marks in which she saw the face of Christ. My mother saw miracles everywhere. When she was a kid back in the Philippines, her own mother would wake her and her brothers and sisters at 3 a.m. on each of the 9 days leading up to Christmas to walk 30 minutes in the dark to a packed church where they would pray the novenas. By the fourth or fifth day, my mom was the only one of the children who could be gotten out of bed. Anytime something good happens, my mom says, "Praise the Lord." And anytime something bad happens, she says it's part of God's plan. She goes to church 6 days a week, and on Good Friday, she hibernates in prayer from noon to three, the hours Christ hung on the cross. Every time she moves, she has a priest bless her new home with holy water, and when she drives, she listens to a Catholic AM radio station or Christian rock CDs. The background on her cell phone is a portrait of Jesus, not a Renaissance classic or an image of suffering, but a handsome, square-jawed, smiling white Jesus with romance novel hair. Whenever I express concern or apprehension about anything big or small, her response is, "Don't worry, God will take care of us." There's a time when I shared that certainty. Over the years, I'd come to doubt that tribulations have greater purpose, that justice awaits the righteous, that misfortune is the product of anything but human malevolence or sheer chance. But I kept this to myself. Why undermine my mother's hope if I had no alternative to offer? Instead, I concentrated on solutions. More and more, our phone calls and texts focused on ways to address her money problems. More and more, I worried about her. Sometimes, shamefully and selfishly, I took out my frustration on her, hardening my voice as if I were the parent and she were a wayward child. Why had she quit a job that seemed stable, even if the boss was an asshole? Why had she left her purse in the back seat of her car for someone to steal? One Christmas morning, when I was back visiting her in California, I saw her put a $50 bill in the collection plate at church. I shot her a harsh look. "Dang, Mom, you don't gotta give him all that." She countered my show of disapproval with an icy glare of true parental force, the one that says, "Boy, you better check yourself," although all she said was, "Albert, it's Christmas."